Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this fine Friday morning. And it is a fine Friday morning. Very nice. Love that you're here. We love that you're with us. We welcome you to be with us also by writing panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce the group to you, and then we will get started. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Well, I'm okay. I have a few problems, not that everybody has to know about them. One is that I gained some weight during COVID. I may not look it, but, you know, you'd have to see my tummy. And and I've been trying. No, you'd have to. Not that I'm inviting you to. I find that I'm getting rid of it. But it's hard once you sort of rely on every 5 minutes looking in the refrigerator, or as we say when you're a certain age, in the icebox. And see what goes on. So that's fine. And then there was David Soares, who will be with us in a moment, I'm sure, who warned me not to go walking, not to announce where I walk, because somebody might jump out of the woods and do something.
And want to have a conversation with you about the latest political issues.
Not exactly. So there's a new added sense of awareness, some might call it paranoia, about who's going to jump out of the woods. Don't you see?
Awareness is good. Paranoia, not so much.
No.
That's not a relaxing walk when you're paranoid and probably have to worry more about the bear. It's always good to be aware of your surroundings, but not to be afraid of them. Just be aware of them.
That's right. As our wonderful Ann Erickson on our board, former chair of our board, would always explain, paranoia will destroy you.
There you go.
We also welcome the other voice you're hearing this morning, Teresa Bourgeois, Cohoes City Director of Operations. They have a wonderful mayor in Cohoes and just fantastic. But let's face it, Teresa runs the place.
Oh, good morning. My goodness. It's not.
You run the city, don't
that's
you?
Not, that's not the not thing that the mayor close. Is going to want to hear.
That's not even close to true. But
well said.
But I am part of an amazingly wonderful, exciting team that works with the mayor to run the city.
And I joke, but Director of Operations gives me a sense that you sort of are overseeing pretty much everything that goes on. Like, you have a sense of what's happening all throughout the city.
I do have a sense of what's happening all throughout the city, but the title really doesn't match mostly what I do. It's just a title that was available, so...
Well, it's a good title.
So it's a good title.
Yeah.
It's on my business card. It's director of, but I am part of the. It really is a wonderful, amazing team. We work very well together and doing a lot of great things.
I know we've mentioned this before, but people don't listen every day and don't listen every week. But we probably haven't talked about this in years. But what I love about this story is that not only are you the director of operations for the city of Cohoes, but that is the city of your birth, and that is where you were brought up. You know that city. You have lived there and know the people and know the place.
Indeed. I was born and raised there, and my parents were very much involved in the community. My father was an elected official, a county legislator for 12 years. My mother was a teacher there for nearly 30 years. My grandmother was an elected official there, and my grandfather ran for mayor, but he was a Republican. She was a Democrat. She won in her campaign to be an alderwoman, and he did not succeed in his campaign to be mayor. But long history of not only living in the community, but being very much a part of the community.
Well, you took us all to a restaurant there at one point. Was it there?
Smith's Restaurant. Yes. It's temporarily closed right now because of the, ongoing issues around the COVID and, restaurants getting back and going. But Smith's is one of the very wonderful parts of Remsen Street. And it's Cohoes is a city with incredible history. We were really at the forefront of textile manufacturing, because the Cohoes Falls are there, and the falls powered the mills. There's a lot of innovation that happened in Cohoes, a lot of patents that came out of Cohoes around powered knitting mills. And the Erie Canal, the most number of flights or locks in the Erie Canal system were in Cohoes.
Really?
Yeah. So lots of history there. And incredible Native American history there, too.
Well, it's an amazing place. Of course, my mom was from Cohoes,
yes.
So I went to
those schools. It's a lovely community.
Yeah, really wonderful. So,
in fact, we, I'm sorry, this is kind of a fun thing. The Food Bank of Northeastern New York.
Yes.
Just to announce, they have this big annual fundraiser called the Mac and Cheese Bowl that they do with the TimesUnion.com with the Steve Barnes table hopping.
Yeah.
And they've decided to come and do that in Cohoes because of our... we've done a lot of outdoor dining in the last 2 years in the midst of the COVID. So they're going to come to Cohoes in March. So people really are, more and more people are coming and enjoying our historic downtown.
By the way, you bring up Steve Barnes' name. And Steve wrote we were telling you yesterday that we lost our friend Sean Stone.
Right.
And Steve wrote a beautiful, beautiful piece that's in the paper today.
Right.
Just a gorgeous obit about Sean. So if you get a chance to look at it, it really is very, very nice.
Tremendous legacy.
Absolutely. Aaron Pasitti is on the phone. He is not here, but he's on the phone, and we'll take it. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. I'm on the phone, and I can't wait to be back.
Well, I have to say, we were just laughing without you, but we were saying that even though it took us a while to get to your introduction, don't worry, because you'll probably be talking the whole show because most of these stories need an economist.
You know, it's one of those things where, like, the crazier the world gets, the more people want to hear from economists. So, you know, I'll take the spotlight when I can. I think in an ideal situation, nobody wants to hear a word from me because the world's moving along just fine without me jabbering.
But now things are bad, right?
No, things seem to be taking an interesting turn in very unexpected ways.
All right.
Interesting. So, that's an interesting word. Interesting.
Yeah.
It often means something else.
There's a little churn in the system. A little churn in the system.
There's a lot to get to. David Soares is supposed to be with us. I keep checking my mail to see if he is, if there is a reason. Maybe I missed something, but I haven't found it yet. So I, with that. Oh, he's David's on the phone? Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Hey, David, how are you? I thought you were coming in. How are you?
Listen, man, I'm good, but Alan started off the conversation by talking about the weight that he put on during COVID.
Yeah.
Alan, listen, man, I was stuck at my house like Yogi Bear with a bunch of picnic baskets and a beautiful woman. At the end of the lockdown, I ended up with 26 pounds and a baby, right?
26 pounds?
And
wow.
A baby.
26 pounds and a baby.
Well, we'll leave that there.
How many pounds was the baby?
Congratulations on the baby.
Thank you so much. I would feel better if the baby came out of me and I lost some of that weight. But I had, you know, that's not how it all works.
No.
But I'm like you. I'm trying to take some stuff off, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, good for you. It's great to hear your voice. I thank you very much for being with us. All right. So we have our group. David Soares is the Albany County District Attorney. Aaron Pasitti is the Siena College economics professor who joins us. And I already welcomed both Teresa and Alan officially, so we can get started and talk about what is on our docket this morning. We welcome you all to... share your letters, panel at WAMC.org. So, and this is what I mean, Aaron, we're going to need you. The supply chain meltdown will make holiday shopping messy this year. Here's what you need to know. This is blasting over the Washington Post, although it has been murmured all over wherever you go. And they'll tell you that it's going to be tough. Every time you pick up a paper yesterday, I believe it was, go to your liquor store early because if you want champagne for the new year, you're not going to get it and the like. So, and that seems to be the case with everything. The pandemic is haunting the global supply chain by extension shoppers. 2 months out from the peak holiday shopping season, consumers are encountering empty store shelves, rising prices, shipping delays that seem to stretch into oblivion. Container ships are clogging ports, awaiting cargo, or unable to get past the gridlock to unload their goods. Some factories have gone dark, lacking raw materials and hands to run machines. I went to the pet store yesterday to pick up some, they're dog treats called Charlie Bears. This is the kind we get, and they're like crispy, and they're good for the dog. Well, they didn't have.
You don't know they're crispy just because you've tried them.
No, they're called crispy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's why I'm only using their. No.
Just want to clarify.
No.
Good point.
And I usually have a handful in any pocket because I'm a lab owner. So, but anyway, I went in and they normally have 500 bags of this, and they had one. And again, there's a little sign that says global supply chain issues are preventing us from getting anything. So shoppers are beginning to fret. A third of the more than 5,700 people recently surveyed by Oracle, which provides cloud services for such large retailers as Prada and Office Depot, worry that they won't get everything on their wish list and will be paying more when they do. Here's what Aaron, the questions are, why are so many store shelves already empty? Do people really need to start shopping now? Is it going to be a lot more? And is then, people who don't necessarily want to shop online, is that pretty much your only alternative?
And if I can add one, Joe, to your very good list, is the question of inflation. Because, as you say, if people are paying more for products and the inflation rate is going up and people aren't happy about it, I kept hearing from all the economists and everybody else, don't worry about inflation, it'll take care of itself. But apparently not.
All right. You have the floor, Aaron Pasitti.
Oh, that's a lot. The good news for me
and
personally
is that
you
got no theme music for in an introduction, man.
Well, yeah, let's get the engineers on that. I am a compulsively punctual person, so like my Christmas shopping is already finished, so this really doesn't pertain to me. But the easiest way to think about what's happening is that the trajectory of the global economy will be determined by the trajectory of global vaccinations. We are going to have, not only in the U.S., but worldwide, an economy that is churning, an economy that is upset, an economy that is out of equilibrium until we get a handle on the public health crisis. So there's two things going on. There is a large-scale supply shortage, and there is a change in the pattern of consumer demand. So if you look at the supply shortage, that's largely resulting from, firms who really shut down or pared down production to, bare bone levels, over the past year and a half. So as all of those firms come back online at the same time, they're all competing for the same raw materials, whether it's, computer chips or steel or whatever the issue is that surge in firms coming back online at the same time is leading to not enough inputs to go around. So the firms bid on those inputs, and that's pushing the prices of raw materials up, which is one reason that we're seeing rising inflation. The second part of that story is a change in the composition of consumer demand. Over the past year and a half, consumers have really pared down their consumption of services like eating out or staying in a hotel or hopping on a plane to go on vacation. With the money that they have saved from consuming less, services and from the savings that they've, been able to increase due to the, three separate rounds of stimulus, consumers are willing to spend, but instead of spending it on services, they're spending it on durable goods.
Yeah.
So durable goods are long-lasting physical items. So, washing machines, computers, TVs, and so on. Consumption of durable goods has gone up 34% over the past year, while the consumption of services has remained relatively flat. So consumers are demanding more and more durable goods. At the same time, suppliers are unable to ramp up production to satisfy that demand. So what you have is a situation where demand for certain products, namely physical goods, the things that people buy for Christmas and birthdays, the demand of those goods is far higher than the supply. So you're going to see empty shelves. You're going to see higher prices for the goods that are on those shelves. And that's likely to be around for a while. To Alan's point, where he was talking about, and I'll throw myself into that category, the idea that inflation is temporary. And the rising inflation we're seeing is largely a byproduct of this mismatch between consumer demand and business supply. One of the reasons we're seeing the supply shortage is because, you know, plants come online and they produce, and then there might be a COVID outbreak, you know, either within that business or within the surrounding area or within the country. They have to lay off workers, so supply goes back down. We're going to have these disruptions as long as COVID is present. The same thing holds for consumers, that consumers are going to, you know, instead of taking vacations and eating out, consumers are choosing to remodel their kitchens and their home office.
Right.
So as long as there's that mismatch between businesses not being able to supply enough and consumers wanting more of that stuff, you're going to see empty shelves and rising prices.
So I have a quick question, and I know everyone wants to get in on this. We have about 75 seconds. So let me just ask you this quick question, and it could be sort of a yes or no answer. And then when we come back, we can you can clarify more. But what we saw at the beginning of COVID, you know, with empty store shelves, that was different, right? Because that was people sort of panic buying. Am I right on that?
Sure.
Okay, so that's different.
Right.
Although this is reminiscent of it, because you still go in and you can't find toilet paper.
Exactly, and that, you know.
But the reasons are different.
The reasons are totally different. Panic buying and people just facing a very unknown future. Now we know what the future looks like. It's just going to be uncertain. So people might be buying in bulk and hoarding just because they need or want something. So yes, those are two very separate behavioral patterns.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll go around the room and have everyone weigh in on this, and obviously a lot more with Aaron and his expertise on the issue. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, Aaron Pacitti, and David Soares. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have a wonderful group this morning: Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, Aaron Pacitti, and David Soares. So, Aaron, we were talking about supply chains and so forth. So right now, if you go in and you aren't finding any pasta on the shelves, is it because they're having trouble making pasta, or is it or is it some in one of these shipyards that you see where the containers are stacked 50 deep?
That's a good question. And it's unfortunately a question I can't provide an answer to, because there are so many parts of the supply chain, right? There's the harvesting of wheat, and then there's the processing of wheat into pasta, and then there's the manufacturing and the shipping and the distribution and the retailing. So when you and that's true for every good. So when you upset one part of that supply chain, say the distribution part, the whole process breaks down. So it's not as if, you know, there's an easy solution to that problem. And I don't want to say it was foreseeable, but, you know, for the past 30 years, you know, most global firms have used a globalized just-in-time inventory and production system where, you know, they're only receiving the necessary goods as needed to meet existing demand. And when that process works, it works great. We get, you know, abundance of goods. There's reliability and certainty about availability. There's stable prices for those goods. But when you tweak one part of that supply chain process, everything falls apart. So, you know, when you're talking about, you know, distribution, you're looking at trucking companies and ports. When you're looking at retail, and you're looking at whether the grocery store has, you know, enough staff to stock the shelf. So it's a very tumultuous time. And, you know, companies are trying to guess what demand's going to be. And, you know, based on, you know, the evidence, it seems like companies have consistently underestimated demand. You saw that with Southwest Airlines,
right?
With some of their, you know, schedule issues and so on. you know, you're trying to forecast something that is inherently unforecastable. There is no historical precedent for a global pandemic in a globalized economy with a just-in-time inventory system. So as simple as this sounds, businesses and consumers are figuring out a very new and different reality on the fly. And that is going to take a lot of time before that settles.
David.
Yeah, there's another issue here that's inextricably intertwined, and it's much to your point. But, Joe, before I make that point, I just want to say your Teresa, you know, after Alan and I had expressed our weight issue, you know, Teresa goes on to mention the mac and cheese bowl, and you're asking Aaron about pasta on the shelf. That was
it was not intentional, although I kind of like that the was made now. But go ahead.
But just like Aaron has mentioned a number of occasions on this show, you know, that the return to our normal economy is through our response to the pandemic, right? It's through vaccinations. Once everyone is vaccinated, then we can begin to open up our stores and open up again. This was a global pandemic. And the fact that we have spent the better part of the last 40 years, creating this global economy where you have, you know, inextricably intertwined supply chains, you know, the reality to us ever returning to normalcy in our country is going to be dependent upon how the globe how the globe is vaccinating itself. And if this comes back to our foreign policy, right, we have to do a much better job of making sure that any excess that we have, that we're, you know, shipping over to our partners overseas, because the health of those countries is going to, you know, impact the health of our economy. And so this idea, and I know that we see attitudes in our country about, well, no, we shouldn't be providing Mexico or be providing, you know, other nations with vaccinations. Well, you know, we're cutting off our nose to spite our face. We cannot have an America first policy when it comes to, you know, the global health, because our economy depends on the health of other nations as well.
Teresa.
Well, David, I agree that with your broader point that, you know, this has really been a wake-up.
That show was insensitive about the pasta reference?
I think we're all on that page, well, David. Don't there. Worry.
You are so funny, David. sorry. That, you know, I think this has been a wake-up call to many about how global our global economy is, and that we have to think about this pandemic in global terms. But I do think people are talking about getting back to normal. I think there's clearly going to be a new normal, and we haven't figured out what that is yet. And it's being redefined. We're never going back to February of 2020. Life will not be like that again, or at least for a long time, I don't think. I'm no expert, but I think that so much of life, including, you know, how we shop and what we buy and where things come from and supply chains, are going to change. And but you're right, David, we do have to work, you know, think about everybody getting vaccinated. That doesn't mean just everybody in our family or community. It means everybody in the global community to deal with this. But also, and this is a question really, how much of a shift as we become realize how much we depend in the United States on goods from elsewhere, how much will this restart the U.S. manufacturing? Will there be incentives to bring things back home? And also, are we going to shift our consumption? I mean, I read all about the holidays and such, and, oh, we have to purchase online. Well, maybe we have to purchase locally. Maybe just like people are buying food more locally, maybe things that are more locally made because they'll be available. And maybe – I know that's not going to solve the dishwashers and washing machine and computer issues, but for some holiday gifts it might. And maybe – resale shops, or, you know, I think we have to think differently about consumption and about stuff. And we're going to be forced to do it in this holiday season just because so much of the stuff that we normally buy is in containers, you know, off the coast of California. But I think that gives us the opportunity to rethink the purchasing of stuff.
Well, Teresa, think about this. The other thing that we have to deal with here is people being willing to live with less. I mean, period. And I think that that is something that could come out of all of this. And I'm not so sure it's a bad thing.
Well, the difference between wants and needs, but also where you get your things, you know, where you purchase things from. That do you purchase locally made things from local shops, or do you purchase from resale shops? If you purchase from resale shops, that helps with the whole environmental question, frankly. And again, that's not going to solve the bigger issues like automobile companies right now. I mean, there's a serious issue with automobile companies because they can't, and, you know, other folks will know this, the details better than me, but you can't get the computer chips that you need for every aspect of a car.
Exactly.
So they can't build the cars, so they can't sell the cars, which is why right now if you have a used car, everybody's calling you and they want to buy it for resale. But I do think that this is creating a major shift in the economy. And we're in the middle of that churn, and we don't know what it's going to look like, but it's not going to look like February of 2020.
Aaron, how's it going to look like for the midterms?
For the midterms?
Yeah.
Yeah. With all of the unknowns and the proclivities of Republican politicians, it's going to be very clear that they're going to be hammering this Biden's policies are making things worse. And, you know, they can point to higher inflation. They can point to empty shelves. I do not think this works to the Democrats' favor in any conceivable way, unfortunately.
Well, I listened to Leader McCarthy's press conference yesterday where, you know, he avoided it all, you know, as much as possible, talking about the Bannon vote and a deal, and just kept saying the word inflation, 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 and economy. And I mean, I think they can't say the word inflation and enough. And of course, taking no responsibility for the, you know, previous administration's role in getting us where we are today. But that's clearly they are, you know, they have a few words.
I agree with you. I agree with you, Teresa. But I'm just going to say it, Joe, because you asked the question. How this is going to affect the midterms.
Yes.
Now, let me just say this. The Democrats will have to blame the Democrats for the midterms because everything that we're talking about here, supply chains, this was foreseeable. We saw this coming. We knew that we weren't going to get back to normal anytime soon. And the fact – and consumers equate how life – going based upon what they can find on the shelf, you know, by the weight cost, because that's how we experience life. And had the Democrats been quicker to respond with the passing the Biden agenda, you know, we would start to feel, right, the benefits of that massive piece of legislation, and that would have tempered some of the things that we're experiencing now supply chain issues.
David,
But the fact that this has been so delayed, people are going to experience some pain before we start to see any positive things flowing from Washington, D.C., and it will hurt the Democrats in the midterm.
David, I don't disagree that there needed to be action sooner, but I think that we need to hold Republicans accountable for not coming to the table and helping to work out a deal. I mean, they have been allowed to sit on the sidelines and, you know, it's all about the Democrats agreeing internally. But what about the responsibility of the Republicans? And a lot of the infrastructure issues we have, I mean, they didn't pass an infrastructure bill in the 4 years that Trump was president. They talked about it. We had infrastructure week over and over again. The infrastructure issues that we have in ports and other things have been long in the making. and the Republicans are getting a free ride sitting on the sidelines in this debate about how to deal with our economy. And I think that they have to be held accountable. You know, why can't three or four or five Republicans in the Senate cross over and help move these human infrastructure and physical infrastructure package? Well, I know the politics of why, but you know, there is as much as responsible.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. But if but the public... Teresa, if the public doesn't know it or agree with what you're saying, it doesn't matter in your admittedly and so excellent wonkiness about telling us, you know, what is as opposed to what ought to be. But the fact of the matter is, if the public doesn't get that, you lose the 22 elections.
But if we don't talk about the fact that they're sitting on the sidelines, not being part of the solution, you know, hoping that it'll help them electorally, and not addressing the fact that it's affecting inflation, it's affecting response to this, they need to be held accountable for sitting in the sidelines, hoping things that go badly, so that they can then win in
absolutely
in,
right.
In,
but it,
in
it,
the
but does it work,
Teresa? Yeah. How politics has worked in Washington D.C.
Yes.
For the better
exactly.
part of the last three, that's essentially the way that politics works right now. The one party stands aside, won't lift a finger. As a matter of fact, worse than that, the Republicans start the fire. They won't put out the fire. And then when the Democrats fail to put the entire fire out, that's what they'll use in their political messaging. Now, I will say this.
But don't brand it as a Democratic failure, though, David. I mean, I understand your point, but it's a Republican failure to engage.
The Democratic failure here is you have the House. By the skin of the teeth, you have the Senate. And people worked so hard in both Arizona and in the state of Georgia to give Democrats that power. And I think the people in Georgia are like, wait a minute. I thought the senator from West Virginia was a Democrat. Wait a second. I thought that the senator from Arizona was a Democrat. We have two people that are holding the entire nation hostage. And it's much easier for a Republican to point the finger and say, look, even when the Democrats are in power, they can't get it done.
Well, I think it's, you know, it's Bernie Sanders.
No, I just have to take a break. But you finish your thought.
I think it's Bernie's, you know, it's the Bernie Sanders camp versus a Manchin camp. But if you had a couple of Republican senators, moderate Republican senators who crossed over, that power would dissipate and we would have had a deal by now. And I think actually, frankly, I think we're very, very close to a deal. I think you're going to see something very soon. The way things are, there's a lot of movement in the background, and I think they're very close to a deal.
And the president seemed to indicate that last night during his town hall.
They moved a bunch of appropriations bills. They're close.
What's the... you had it out on? We'll take
a... I want my coffee.
All right.
He's bored by all my wonkiness.
We'll take a break. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us. We have letters, and we have a lot of letters. So let me get to those. Erica says, I absolutely love this. You don't need 80% of the quote-unquote stuff you buy. Do you have food? Do you have shelter? Do you have electricity? Sorry you can't get that dog sweater or new iPhone. I hope it makes everyone think twice about all that they consume. Perhaps Christmas will be what it's supposed to be about. All right. Then we go to Tom. At this time, we are concerned about trivial items, dog treats, Christmas presents, etc. The crisis is the nexus of labor shortages. Every price is rising and transportation disruptions. I assume transportation issue, which we are concentrating on, will be elevated, but labor and energy, not so much. So wait until it becomes a shortage of food, not Doritos, and medicine. This will be very severe and difficult. This could literally become a matter of life and death. Do not ignore this problem. Aaron Pasitti.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this when David and Teresa were talking, and, you know, despite everybody bringing up good points about, you know, supply chain issues, the really remarkable story to me is just how well supply chains have worked through a global pandemic. As the letter writer pointed out, you know, we can still walk into the grocery store and buy bananas and chicken and, you know, milk. It's not a matter of life and death just yet. You know, not having enough toilet paper is, you know, there are substitutes, but, you know, it's
not viable ones.
I understand that. I guess what I'm trying to say is the supply chain has been remarkably resilient, mm-hmm. and it's incredible how little, stress the average consumer has been placed under in terms of actually getting things they really, really, really need.
Stephen writes us a note and says, in a normally functioning economy, something of value is created in exchange for dollars. Can you speak to the issue of what happens when a government creates trillions of dollars without creating any value, i.e. the underlying goods or services? It seems to me you could end up in an economy where everyone is, quote unquote, rich, but has nothing to buy. Aaron.
Yeah, no, excellent question. Well, when the government spends money, it does create value. It's not like the government's just, you know, printing money and sending it out to, you know, pay the military and give people stimulus checks. This isn't, you know, Zimbabwe in the 2000s. When the government spends money to, you know, fund Social Security or infrastructure, it does create value. So, I mean, to me, government spending is I call it government investment, because it is investment in, you know, human resources, physical resources. So there is value created by what the government spends. It might not be the value we want to see created, but it's. I think it's incorrect to view government spending as having no inherent value. If it's a transfer of money from the government to somebody else, that other person, whoever that is, spends the money on goods and services, and that's the whole point of how government spending and investment works. It is the starting point that generates economic activity when an economy is depressed.
Teresa.
Aaron, I have a question about, because part of this is the labor shortage, because people don't want to go, you know, work for reasons which some of which I don't understand. But pre-pandemic, there was a gulf, a difference between what the management was being paid and what workers were being paid. You know, the percentage difference between the CEO's salary and the worker's salary, and there was a lot of issues about fair wages and such. Do you think that in response to this, if wages increase, that will bring people back to work? Is that part of the solution to have some, what some would call equity or fairness in wages, and other would call wage inflation, depending on your perspective?
Yeah, excellent question. The short answer is yes. You know, that's higher wages will entice people to come off the sidelines. The issue is that, you know, inflation-adjusted wages in the United States have really stayed constant for the past four decades. So you've seen very little ground gained in terms of, you know, the average worker's wage relative to the cost of living. So we need wage inflation. You know, there's good inflation and there's bad inflation. Good inflation is that people are earning higher incomes, they're able to buy more. There are easy ways to deal with the inflation that generates, and that's having the Federal Reserve step in and raise interest rates to kind of, you know, very technocratically and precisely bring inflation down. We're not going to see anything like we saw in the late 1960s and 1970s, where workers' wages were increasing, you know, 8 to 10% a year. But it is time for, you know, a nationwide raise. So this whole, you know, tumultuous churning period. We talked about the supply chain issue, but there's the whole labor market issue. And, you know, what are workers doing who have lost their job or decided to rethink their priorities? And it's another one of those situations where, you know, the dust on that is not going to settle probably for another 5 or 10 years. And I don't see that as a bad thing. It's just a shock to the system that allows people to kind of reconsider their priorities, what's important to them, what they're willing to do. And it does, in that context, represent a once-in-a-lifetime political opportunity to implement policies that will have that will make that process goes more smoothly and be more beneficial to more people in the long term. So Biden's American Jobs Plan, which is the infrastructure package, and his American Families Plan, which is the human resources and education and childcare part, could not be better timed. And I truly think that if these do not get passed before the 2022 midterms, then they probably will not get passed, and we will have witnessed a once in a lifetime opportunity to recalibrate the social safety net disappear.
We have many other topics. Well, go ahead, David. We got about a minute, but go ahead.
I'm so happy that you said that, Aaron, because this is one of the most pivotal moments in the history of our country. Because if the Democrats, and understanding, Teresa, when I say the Democrats, I just don't even think of the Republican Party as a governing body anymore. So I won't even bother with that, because they elect clowns to represent, you know, to be at the Capitol. But my point here is the reason why this is such a pivotal moment is because we are either going to have legislation that addresses Americans and where we are at right now so that we can rethink the way that we live and move forward. Or if we fail to do that, then what we have is a pool of grievance that is going to be much larger than that pool that Donald Trump found and was able to build his movement on. And so that's why we should all be very concerned in this moment.
All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have many, many letters on this, so we'll go ahead with those. Why don't we? Maureen says, Teresa is right. Teresa identified a real problem with the current political discourse, the media. The news is framed without a reality perspective that would show the Republicans for the recalcitrant obstructionists that they have been during the past 5 years. Governing is not a zero-sum game, but that's how it is portrayed. And I would think that the counter to that, which we've been discussing on the show over the last several weeks, is that, okay, that is maybe a fair point, but also that the Democrats should take a certain amount of responsibility for the messaging that they have. That, yeah, if you improve the messaging, then the media then would follow.
Correct. I don't blame this on the media as much as I blame it on the messaging. Well, part of it is the media holding them accountable, but the way the media is going to hold them accountable is if the Democrats start talking about the fact that the Republicans have a responsibility to step up and be a part of this conversation to solve the problems for the American people, not sit back and hope that doing nothing helps them win in the next election. And that the way that the voters should decide whether or not they win in the next election is what they're doing right now. And if voters think that Republicans sitting on the sidelines is the best for them and for their families and for their life and, you know, for their communities, then go ahead and vote for them. But I think sitting around doing nothing in the midst of a global pandemic and an economic, shift and not working to try to figure out ways to help navigate through that economic shift is not, something that you should get reelected for doing.
Meanwhile, we have a letter from Susan who says, looking at today's papers, the general word is that we are closer than ever to getting the Build Back Better Act than the infrastructure and then the infrastructure bill passed. So let's repeat that over and over and over again. Send out that positive message and hopefully have a good impact on getting Dems into office in 2 weeks. I feel much more hopeful now. So 2 points. One, I think you may have written that letter, Teresa. Two, Alan, do you share the optimism of the letter writer?
Well, first of all, I happen to, unlike so many others, I happen to believe that the polls offer us some snapshots here, and it ain't good. And the polls are basically showing that the Democratic message, perhaps, and I think that's why Biden went out there yesterday, I guess it was, with a smile on his face and some good humor and said, we're making progress and we're going to make it. Because if people think you're not going to make it, then they say, oh, they're a bunch of losers. I am thinking right now it's not a good time for the Democrats. It's not a good time for Biden. Unless he could produce, I think it's going to get worse.
But I think the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democrats need to take the win. And if they don't get 100% of what they wanted, if they get 60%, if they get 50% of what they wanted, take the win.
Is it your sense they won't do that, Teresa?
I don't know if they will or won't. But this is, you know, the difference between rhetoric and governing. And right now we need to govern. And governing is compromise. And a lot of change will come even if we can get half of what was on the table. I know it would be better to get 100%. But you heard this in the President Biden's CNN discussions last night. And David, you may disagree with me on this, but I do think that the getting the infrastructure bill and the basic framework of a human infrastructure package is better than getting nothing.
David?
I agree with you on that. I do, Teresa. I think where we may have, you know, some slight disagreements is the Democrats spending any time messaging around, you know, Republicans. Republicans are being rewarded by the Republican base for their terrible, terrible behavior. Where I think that Democrats have utterly failed is actually discussing what is in the Build Back Better bill,
right,
and how that would benefit everyone, and especially making sure that those discussions and the messaging is being directed specifically in Arizona and being directed specifically in West Virginia. And the only thing we continue to hear about this bill are the votes and what the vote count is. And we keep elevating the stature of these two people who I think are Democrats. Every time we talk about you know, they're holding out, as opposed to how are Americans, both Republicans, right, and Democrats, going to benefit from this Build Back Better bill? And I think we've done a terrible, when I say we, I mean Democrats, we've done a terrible job communicating the contents of those bills.
Well, here's an example around the community colleges. I'm a big fan of community colleges. So the, you know, one part of the Democratic Party says free college for all, free college for all. And another part says, no, we can't afford that. So the compromise is to expand dramatically the Pell Grants. Well, Manchin and the conservative Democrats say, fine, let's expand the Pell Grants, because that will dramatically increase access to community colleges for middle and lower income people. Take that as a win. Don't, you know, if that's where we end up, then let's not say, oh, we didn't help into community colleges, when in fact, if we expand the Pell Grant significantly to give access to working class and low-income people so that they can get into community college, that's a win, and we shouldn't have that lost in the rhetoric about, oh, you know, Biden is going with Manchin on no free college. Why don't we say, the compromise is, let's dramatically expand Pell Grants so that lots more Americans working in middle class have access to community college.
So let's face it, you're basically calling out the left in the Democratic Party.
Everybody, frame it like David said. Talk about the
issues. You're a moderate. David is a moderate. I'm a moderate. But there is a large crowd out there saying, I want, I want, I want. And it seems to me that is where the danger lies with the Democrats.
I think big change is hard, and sometimes you have these debates, and if you compromise, you can get, you know, something is better than nothing. You know, when I was working with Kennedy on health care, we didn't get the big bill, but out of that came the funding for Child Health Plus, and lots more supports in lots of different directions, and eventually it built up to the point where you got Obamacare. And as President Biden was talking about last night, and I'm not an expert on this, but when he was talking about when Social Security passed, it didn't look then like it looks now. It was a foundation for what we now know.
Mm-hmm.
So you make these changes, you expand the infrastructure for, you know, the human infrastructure supports, and you keep building on that. Take the win.
So let me just alter. I'm just going to shift the conversation slightly into an economic rebound that is still waiting for workers. We look at this, they're reading in the New York Times, despite school reopenings and the end of some federal aid, many people are in no rush to land a job. Savings and health concerns are playing a role. And we've talked about this on the show, but the labor force shrank in September. There are 5 million fewer people working than before the pandemic began, and 3 million fewer even looking for work. Aaron, what does that mean, and how important is that in the broader context of the conversation we're having this morning?
You know, I don't think a labor shortage is holding back a recovery. I think a labor shortage is, you know, throwing some sand into the gears of the recovery. And there's obviously a few forces at play here. And I believe Teresa brought this up earlier, is that, you know, a lot of the jobs that were lost were in leisure and hospitality, in addition to face-to-face services. I can only sympathize with workers who have a public-facing job who have to deal with, you know, enforcing mask mandates and, you know, dealing with a very angry public and a very entitled public, and doing that for, you know, $12 an hour doesn't always seem worth it. So it is nice in some ways to see workers being able to flex a little bit and say, you know, I'm going to figure out a way to make this work without a job. So I think people are fundamentally rethinking their priorities. And because of that rethinking, this is a prime opportunity, again, for the Biden administration to lay some foundation that can better equip, you know, these millions of workers who are not looking for a job or are concerned about the quality of the jobs that are on offer, and, you know, lay the foundation for job training programs or community college. The one interesting data released this week was the Census Bureau reported there were 5 million new small business applications over the past 12 months. So just because these workers are not seeking formal employment doesn't mean they're just, you know, sitting on the couch watching The Price is Right every day. A lot of
not
these
that there's
workers
anything wrong with that. Go ahead.
No, of course there's nothing wrong
he
with
said
that.
As a fan.
You know, we
all need our dose of Plinko. Go ahead.
So I hear. But, you know, a lot of when people are rethinking their job opportunities, a lot of them are, you know, taking some initiative towards entrepreneurship. And, you know, some of these companies are very likely satisfying demand that did not exist in February 2020. Right. So people are, you know, creating businesses that might be addressing what is going to be a very new normal. So I don't see the shortage of workers as hobbling the recovery. The supply chain issues and the lack of production has more to do with, you know, the things I was talking about earlier, just the lack of raw materials and higher prices. It's not because businesses can't hire enough workers. It's that they're dealing with such an uncertain environment regarding public health and the availability of raw materials. That's the larger issue. People rethinking their career trajectories and going back to school or applying and starting a new business or waiting for better job opportunities to come if they can afford it. These are all good things that are going to be inconvenient in terms of how the economy functions. But when you think about the long term, these are changes that could be beneficial and help shape a new normal that is more friendly to workers.
So I have a question for you. When the Democrats recalibrated their thing, brought it down from 3.5 trillion, one of the things that fell apparently were community colleges, the very thing that you aged to community college. Am I wrong about that?
You are.
I am wrong. Are you sure? Because I was watching CNN this morning, and they had a list of the things that were out.
So what's out is they wanted free community college for everyone.
That's right.
But what's in is a significant increase in Pell grants available to middle and work. So,
right, because that was more acceptable.
So what it does is – but also you will see in the – energy, water appropriations bill and other bills, there is a significant amount of funding for workforce development in the clean economy. And Aaron alluded to this earlier, that because as you're trying to shift to a cleaner, greener economy, you're going to need a workforce who responds to that. So not only is there Pell Grant money, but there are also there's also a lot of resources for nursing education, for clean energy education, you know, for healthcare education, for to trying to fill in the gaps of, or the worker gaps.
The last person I want to argue with is you, because you know so much. But my issue is that the direct aid to the community colleges was there in the original bill. It is not there anymore. You say, well, it's shifted. You can still get it from the Pell Grants. But one of the cuts was this aid to community colleges.
One of the principal goals is free college, free tuition for anybody who wants to go to community college. That's not in there, but as I understand it, what they are doing instead is dramatically see, this is where it's easy to say free community college. It's harder to say, well, instead, we're going to do the following five things that are going to create increased access to community colleges. But that, in fact, is what they're doing. So they're not saying, no, we don't care about community college. Obviously, the president's wife, you know,
is a community college. who backs this plan, right?
Yeah. As they said, you know, you had a, how did you explain to her that you're giving up free community college for everybody? He said, tough conversation. But
there is symbolism.
But it's not
here.
That they're doing nothing. It's not that they're doing
nothing. No,
no, it's hard to explain.
But they did. But they did, Teresa, I'm sorry for interrupting, but they did cut that provision out of the $3.5 trillion.
And this is where I'm saying that the Bernie Sanders wing needs to not just say, oh, we lost on community colleges. They need to be talking about how, you know, we're taking a different approach. It's not one we preferred, but we've dramatically increased support for community colleges.
Well, that is the line, all right.
Aaron?
Yeah, no, Teresa is correct on that. Unfortunately, that does make the messaging for Democrats a lot harder because, you know, it's like, well, now they're listen to the details about how you can qualify for these grants is less has a lot less public appeal and sexiness than free 2-year community college.
Right.
So, you know, that, you know, the nuances make it very difficult to have effective messaging. But I think the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, and I consider myself part of this group, is that you need leverage in negotiations. And if you start with the ultimate objective as being free 2-year community college, you hold on that as long as possible until you get people to either cave or come up to some solution. So I don't, framing the progressive wing of the Democratic Party as being like the Tea Party, where it's just a scorched earth policy if they don't get what they want, I think is misleading. I think what they're trying to do is create some leverage. And if you hold out on some big things, you force people to your side. And it's a rare opportunity to have, you know, essentially New Deal Democrats, who are the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, have an opportunity both politically and, you know, with the current economic climate to exercise that leverage and shoot for the moon. And if you get halfway there, that's how American politics works. It's incrementalism outside of maybe the New Deal in World War II. It's largely building on existing programs and expanding them, moving towards some further goal. It's very clear with, you know, the lack of govern, you know, the Republicans have no interest in governing. So at this point, Democrats are only negotiating with themselves. And that's unfortunately a counterproductive strategy. But if it's one where I think very progressive ideas that were in Biden's original plans have the best opportunity of coming to fruition.
David?
Look, I don't think anywhere in life we get everything that we want, right? And in this moment, we cannot allow for the perfect to be the enemy of the good. And so I think it's actually rather genius, right, that if you have to negotiate and say, okay, well, we're not going to do the free community college for everyone, but we're going to increase scholarships for people to get that to me is a win. And there is a skillful way of making that, of delivering that message, to not make it appear as though we've completely caved in that. Because you're going to need creativity here. 3.5, not going to get the 3.5. I think we know that. But what is it that the Democrats can deliver that it's going that is going to be transformational in the lives of people? And the thing is, and I hate to come back to it, can it be done in time to stave off some of the absurd messaging that you're going to hear from the Republicans come the midterms?
And once they get an agreement and it gets locked in and they pass it before December 3rd, will then Democrats join in celebrating it as opposed to bemoaning that it's not 100%? That's what I'm hoping, that they join in celebrating the change that we've been able to bring.
We hear the baby, which is really exciting.
Yeah.
I was thinking about what's that baby's future going to be like, you know?
I'm sure David hasn't thought about that at all.
Like, this is a time of churn and swirl, but, you know, so much innovation is going to happen to change that child's life.
Madalena is the baby's name.
Oh, beautiful.
What do you call her Madalena, or have you shortened it to Maddie, or what are you using these days?
Maddie, and will you please stop crying?
Those are the two names. Will you please stop crying?
Those are the names.
Well, you know, all the pictures that your wife puts up on Facebook, there are no tears, only happiness and joy and smiles on that baby's face. So
there's a lot of forgiveness when that baby wakes up and just looks at you and gives you a coo and even spits out milk. There's a lot of forgiveness.
Well, I know you as a forgiving person. All right, let's go to a couple of letters here before we go to a break at the bottom of the hour here. We go to this one. The thing that determines the value in government spending is how the money is introduced into the economy. When it goes in at the bottom, it produces value because it gets spent and spent again and again, creating value each time. When the money is introduced at the top, it sits in one bank account and does nothing for the economy. Is that basically true, Aaron?
In general, yes, which is why you see, like, government spending on, say, since we've been talking about community colleges. Government spending on community colleges, you know, the government has to borrow money or raise taxes to fund that. But those investments have a very long-term payoff. Right, you're talking about decades of having a more productive workforce. You're having higher employment rates. Employed people pay taxes, so those investments pay for themselves, and they tend to have a much higher rate of return on programs that tend to benefit, you know, lower and middle income households as opposed to upper income households.
Bill writes, Aaron is exactly correct. So many of us are simply reevaluating how we want our lives to look. Why go back to a job that you didn't like in the first place? Seek out the work that you actually want. Then we go to this from Lars. Budget rhetoric has been constructed by and for the Republicans. Democrats need to change how they discuss policy and investments. Get rid of the words spending, debt, and social safety net. Replace them with investments, worth, and basic human needs. One more letter I think we have time for, which is we have to get approved vaccines over to all areas of the world, i.e. Africa, Malaysia, etc., so people will heal. We can't have people jumping on airplanes not vaccinated from anywhere. We need to make their governments let the vaccine through. That's a lot of the problem. Stop trying to change anti-vaccine persons for a while. Concentrate on getting the entire pro-vaccine population in the world jabbed. Just my thinking on this issue.
Well, the problem with that is it's not either or. I mean, obviously, you got to get the people in the United States to do it, and it's great if you can get the people around the world to have the advantage, too.
And that was David's very important point early on.
Yeah.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll have our last go-round with our terrific panel, Alan Chartok, David Soares, Aaron Pasitti, and Teresa Bourgeois. We welcome you joining us as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We are on our last call here for topics and news, and with our wonderful group this morning, Alan Chartok, David Soares, Teresa Bourgeois and Aaron Pasitti. You know, one of the weirdest, I know this wasn't on our docket today, but one of the weirdest stories that I've heard of in a really long time is this Alec Baldwin story. Director of photography killed and a movie director injured after Alec Baldwin discharged a prop firearm on a movie set. And this is, you know, the prop guns aren't supposed to have real bullets in them. And duh, right? But, I, you know, obviously there'll be an investigation, but you think of how that happens, and I just, you know, it's hard to compute and to have it make any sense whatsoever. It's an odd story.
It's just tragic.
Yeah.
So tragic. You know, I, like, I love watching movies, sci-fi. In today's movies, the technology exists, right, where you see lasers coming out of the hands of people, right? I don't understand why it is that we need to actually see, you can have the, you can actually have the gun, but why does the gun actually have to, why does it have yet to squeeze the trigger and have a blank come out of it when all of that can be done in the editing and in the post work to prevent these things from happening? Because it's not the only time that, that something like this has happened. And so, it's with heavy hearts today.
Yeah, it's a weird story. And, you know, just because, as you say, it has happened before. There was Brandon Lee, the son of Bruce Lee, who was killed when he was struck by a bullet from a gun that was supposed to just have blanks. But there was a bullet lodged in the barrel. That was in 93 for the movie The Crow. So, it, yes, it has happened before. And, you know, you think of how important the people who work on these films are and how good they are at their jobs. And, you know, it's they're dealing with often on films, because we tend to watch films where people get shot and things blow up, which says a lot about us, doesn't it? That normally people know how to deal with that, and it's safe. And when it isn't, it is a one-off, and it's odd. But yeah, it's a really sad story. Very strange.
Well, David, you must have some, you know, awareness of accidental deaths due to guns that you have to deal with, and tragedies in your world, you know, with in your work. But it's not. It's
oh my goodness. Unfortunately, those are the statistics that you know, with such powerful lobbies like the NRA prevent. You know, like for example, the ATF from maintaining, even though they do. You do have that kind of that data that exists out there, but accidental shootings are as common an occurrence daily in this country, because we have over 600 million guns out into the universe of our American society. So, yes, you're going to have these events take place, and these are so preventable, because we also, you know, have a lot of tools that are available to us to maintain safety in the home. And but I go back to a movie set where every single detail is so scrutinized. And again, it leaves you wondering why it is that we even need to have, even though they're not live rounds, why do we even need to have blanks in a movie when a lot of that can be done through special effects?
Yeah, absolutely. All right. We have a few moments, so let's end with this story. Liz Cheney's consultants are given an ultimatum: drop her or be dropped. A prominent Washington lobbyist close to Kevin McCarthy, the House minority leader, is warning Republican political consultants they must choose between working for Representative Liz Cheney or Mr. McCarthy, an ultimatum that marks the full rupture between the two House Republicans. Jeff Miller, the lobbyist and a confidant of Mr. McCarthy's dating to their youthful days in California politics, have conveyed this us or her message to Republican strategists in recent weeks, prompting one fundraising firm to disassociate itself from Ms. Cheney, a Republican from Wyoming. In response, the Morning Group, a fundraising firm she hired to help prepare for a primary next year against a challenger endorsed by President Donald Trump, former President Donald Trump, informed her last month, and I just lost the
Well, basically, while you're looking for it, Joe, I got to tell you, if you were a betting person, you would bet among Republicans she's toast.
Yeah. So the morning group was said that they could no longer work on her campaign, according to Republicans familiar with the matter. That was what
were you going to say, Teresa? I'm sorry.
Well, I don't know that she's toast. I think that this actually, to me, this is interesting in that it shows how McCarthy's concerned, because clearly there's a battle for the soul of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
And I think she's playing the long game, and she thinks over time that, I don't know, but it just as a, you know, watching from afar, she is betting that over time people will grow weary of the Trump folks, and that her, you know, that there are probably many, many Republicans in the caucus who their hearts are with her, but they're just afraid to shift.
Wishful thinking, I think.
It's a gamble. I mean, I think that's the card she's playing. And I think that he is pulling out all stops to have somebody running against her in the district and to make it as hard as possible for her to prevail, which means he's running scared, which is a sign of weakness.
Well, you could well be right that he's doing what he doesn't have to do, in my opinion. Look, they kicked her out of her position, a third-ranking person in the House of Representatives on her committee, in the House of Representatives, period. I think there are indications that they could get away with getting rid of her. So I have great admiration for her. I think she comes out of the Bush part of the Republican Party, and I think that's what this has all been about. And I think it adds up to integrity on her part.
David?
Yeah. Liz Cheney is one of these – she's one of those subjects that whenever I start thinking about her, I think about her policies. And her policies are horrible.
Right.
Awful.
Right.
But true.
But despite, you know, her ideology, you have to look at her and say, my goodness, you know, I get it. You have to respect her. And she is playing the long game. And I have to believe that there's a vast majority of Republicans that are out there. They're not the vocal part of the Republican Party, but they're the people that are going to be without a party pretty soon if this virus – if this virulent strain of the Trump virus continues to spread through this party, they're going to have to find some home to go to. I don't see it being the Democratic Party, but perhaps it's the birth of a third party.
So I'm going to ask you a question real fast. Do you think there is a possibility that Donald Trump will be, because I do, will be elected president of the United States now that they've put the fix in Arizona and all the Pennsylvania and all these other places?
I think it'll be harder, but I don't think he ever becomes president of the United States again.
You're in mouth God's ear.
Aaron.
No, I think what's happening is McCarthy is making an example of Cheney as a warning to other Republicans, you know, saying, if you don't toe the party line, we will use every tool we have to prevent you from getting money and maintaining your seat.
But not that he's scared. In other words, if McCarthy, there are two ways. Teresa's point is, I think, extremely well taken. There's a possibility that McCarthy thinks she'll survive, and he has to do everything in his power to make sure she doesn't.
Sure. No, this is to me a no lose situation for McCarthy, right? Like it sends him. I mean, she has a lot of political capital. A lot of more junior Congress people don't have that much capital, and warnings and actions like that from McCarthy are going to trickle down, and it's going to force lower ranking members of Congress to get in line, and it's coalition building from the crazy radical right. So even if he does see Cheney as a threat, fine. But I think that move pays off in spades in terms of keeping the Republican crazy base in order.
Well, this is a leadership fight. I mean, it's a leadership fight. What was more interesting in that story to me is that they are funding some of the people who voted for impeachment, some of those Republicans, some of those nine Republicans, he has not blocked funding for them. So
they want to take the House.
Yeah, so that was interesting to me. So that's So for him, it's really a leadership. To me, that signals it's a fight for leadership, that he sees her as a true threat to his leadership, and he wants to be speaker.
New news, tens of millions of Americans can sign up to get Moderna and Johnson & Johnson boosters beginning today. After the nation's top public health official endorsed recommendations from expert advisors that the shots are safe and effective at bolstering protection against the coronavirus. The green light from Rochelle Walensky, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, means that eligible Americans at risk of severe disease can choose any of the three boosters now authorized in the United States, regardless of their original shot. The evidence shows that all three COVID-19 vaccines authorized in the U.S. are safe, as demonstrated by over 400 million vaccine doses already given, Walensky said in a statement. Also, they are highly effective in reducing the risk of severe disease, hospitalization, and death, even in the midst of widely circulating Delta variant. So for a while, just the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks, that Pfizer vaccines were booster vaccines were available to those who had received the Pfizer. Now, if you had received Moderna or Johnson & Johnson or any of the above, you can get a booster and you can pick which one you want.
Good thing, I say. What do you lose?
Get vaccinated. That's what I say. Go get vaccinated.
And
a great day.
Yeah. And doesn't it seem like you're, I would think most people have questions that between pharmacists and
your own doctor
and doctors and
call your doctor's office,
your primary care doctor, they'll be able to help you in making that decision as to what you get, when you get it, and right. So forth. All right, we are out of time. My thanks to everybody this morning for being with us. Alan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe.
Have a great weekend. Teresa, great to have you in the studio.
Appreciate delighted to
it.
Be here.
Wonderful
and so nice to hear
here.
That baby in the background. Thank you, David.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you, guys.
I'm sure you love it all, too. And, David, always good to talk to you. Aaron, thank you very much. We'll be in touch. We'll be right back after this.